Time for a review of some of the most interesting political stories of the last couple of months. Chuck Coughlin is back with us. He's one of the most astute observers of our political scene. He's our guest in this week's Think Tank.
From KTAR News, this is The Think Tank, hosted by Dr. Mike O'Neill.
Hey, welcome back, Chuck.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
Well, I think we may have a rare instance. We chatted a little bit before turning on the microphones. You for a change, have come around to what I think was my position, and the subject was Kyrsten Sinema. And you thought that she had a path to victory. I looked at it and said, I don't see it.
Yeah.
You're having a change of heart on that one.
Well, I still believe she's got a path. It's really, really difficult, though. It's supremely difficult.
Because, I sure don't argue with your arithmetic. Yeah. I just don't see how she gets that,
well,
particularly of the Republicans and Democrats.
It would be an enormously difficult task, but not impossible. I mean, her narrative, if she wanted to own the narrative, let's say she stays in the race, which or steps into the race at this point. I'm not sure she is, but let's say she is going to do that. She can own a narrative. She can own all of Biden's successes, all of the legislative accomplishments that have been done, from the marriage stuff to the gun bills to the infrastructure bill to everything that Biden has gotten through. She can claim ownership.
Because he needed her vote in order to do everything.
And she got it done.
Yep.
And so she can claim that. And she got 10, you know, Republican votes in the Senate every time for her, so they could get by the rules. So there's a credible narrative there. I just don't see her making it, Mike. I just don't see her out there. And she should be doing that, in my estimation, now or very, very soon in a very, very loud manner. I'm talking about paid media advertising. I'm talking about social media advertising. I'm talking about capturing the narrative. If she is going to be in the race, she is going to be the subject of the race, whether you're Ruben Gallego or, say, a Carrie Lake. She is going to be the topic. It's not going to be anything else. So it's up to her to define the narrative of the campaign. And I don't quite frankly see them gearing up to do that.
But they got the money.
They can do it. Yeah. They can do
it. She's not raising it quick, but she's got
six years
of accumulation.
Right. And the last quarter, you know, was not great. So you're seeing a momentum drop off there. And so my speculation is this, that, you know, we're going to go through this period where, you know, Carrie Lake will probably announce sometime in September. October, she's on this little book tour now, you know, selling her little comic book narrative. And so she's out there doing that. So she runs out of gas on that over a period of time. So she's back and puts a few quarters in the meter and starts raising money again to go make that. So that defines the race.
In terms of Carrie Lake, you have to say of all the candidates from the last go round, she has clearly been the one that continues to be in the public eye.
Right.
Not necessarily for good reasons.
I mean, but I would also argue that her base has probably shrunk from the time of the last gubernatorial election, because she's done nothing to enhance and to grow that base. Right. It stayed right where it is. So she may be vulnerable to a very, very courageous Republican like a Blake Masters or somebody like that that chose to take them on. But it's going to be hard. That will equally be very hard. But the easy way out is go let Carrie exhaust herself. Let her own that nomination. That shapes the field. Then it's up to Kyrsten to say, am I in or am I out? And I suspect, given the numbers that I'm seeing, we pulled some data about a month ago that showed that Ruben's at a roughly a 34, 35, Kyrsten at 16. That's a steep climb.
That's a poor third.
It's a poor third, right. Yeah. That means you have a lot of work to do to try and convince people to bring them home to you.
I hadn't seen Carrie Lake that high. I thought Ruben had more of a lead than that. That's a closer race than I'd seen.
It does, but then her votes become the swing votes.
Oh, absolutely. Her votes determine the victory.
Right. It's as if she is still sitting in the U.S. Senate. Her votes determine the victory. And so...
Okay, so that then the question is, and you probably know this, okay, that 16% that Sinema gets, who do those people look like? Who are they?
Well, they're not Lake voters. They're certainly not Lake voters. I would say they're more credibly Gallego voters, but... Not really, because they're not really that progressive of a voter. Mm-hmm. And so they are more people who respect, you know, that tradition of independent and independent thinking that runs through Arizona politics. And it taps into that that narrative of independence that people like, that a lot of Arizona voters like, that shaped a lot of McCain's narrative, that shaped back in the day some of Goldwater's narrative or Udall's narrative. You know, it was this bipartisan, we're here to serve the voters of Arizona narrative.
Any chance Doug Ducey would jump into this? Because he would seem to be the ideal Republican candidate.
I just don't see it. Mm-hmm. I've never believed that he wanted to be a legislator, which he's very comfortable being an executive, a CEO, which, you know, I've always said there's 51 good jobs, political jobs in the country. There's 50 governors and the president. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is just an actor on the stage.
Yes, and I think Senator McCain put it, this to be 1/100th of one half of 1/3 of the government.
Right. And that's the kind of humility you need to have in those positions, because you got to be a team player. You got to figure out where the river is flowing and how you can influence that outcome
without being able to do anything.
Right. It's a relational thing. And so it's interesting. I just don't see that is his skill set. I mean, I just saw him, you know, as governor. I can tell you, he just did not have any over the course of his 8 years. I can't tell you a single legislator that he had a deep personal relationship with.
Well, the reason I threw out that name is I'm looking at names on the Republican side. You could go with establishment types. Mm-hmm. Jeff Flake, you know, he quit because he couldn't win. And who is it there that kind of played with the MAGA people enough to be okay and yet, you know, kind of has a foot in the establishment as well? And I don't know there's anybody else.
You know, the guy that you're talking about is Jeff DeWitt. But he's now chairman of the GOP, and he's found out he can't operate in that environment. Mm-hmm. It's impossible for him to operate in that environment. There's really nobody else that pops into my radar screen other than one of the candidates that ran against Mark Kelly last time. A Blake Masters, a Jim Lehman, somebody who's invested in statewide name ID and has a following within the GOP and can talk to and grow that coalition on the Republican side, and then make the case that Carrie Lake's just not electable.
Yeah, but they have the same problem. They've run from the far right, and
they do
in terms of attacking anybody with an independent streak.
Gates and Lehman have not so much done that, but you know they've not invested in it as Lake has isn't chasing the rabbit. But they clearly could still mount a campaign. Again, very, very hard campaign though. Not a layup. You're not starting this campaign with, I got a really good shot to win this. You're sort of saying, I got a 50-50, maybe a 40-60 shot at taking this down, but it's an uphill climb. But most everything, that's the weird thing that I'm finding, you know, with some of the other stuff we're working on, most everything these days in that genre of partisan elections is very, very, very hard. Unless you just take the extreme view of a woke Democrat or a populist Republican.
I'm intrigued by the Stephen Richards, I assume you follow,
lawsuit.
I mean, those election officials have basically taken punch after punch after punch of completely unsupported charges, but which significant chunks of people believe. Rare instance where he's fighting back. With a lawsuit.
I thought it was really creative in the way he's chosen to do that. He's a lawyer. He has a lot of good legal support around him. And he chose a very creative way to go back at this.
It is a straightforward lie. It seems to me, you know, that he's a public figure. So the bar is high. You have to prove that the statements are not only false, but they were either intentionally false or in total substantial disregard of overwhelming evidence. And it seems to me they may have that, though. Even though that normally you say public officials don't bother because you have to prove actual malice.
Yeah.
Between what's out there, the number of court cases that have come down that says there's no evidence, and the possibility of discovery of internal emails and things like that, a la Fox News. Once they got the fishing expedition
in
the discovery,
right?
And who knows what's in there? Something like, we know this is, but we're making a lot of money at these charges, so let's keep going.
Discovery on the fundraising trail and saying, hey, we're going to have this loss in court, and then we're going to have an email the next day that says we were screwed and we're going to go raise more money, even though we know, you know, we don't have anything to
support. We're not
going to
win in court, but the money is going to keep rolling.
Is that stuff there in discovery? Yeah. You know, I've talked to some lawyers. They all say it'll be a hard thing to do
because of the public figure thing.
You know, the biggest skeptic I always go to is my former boss, Mr. Rob, who praised the thought that he thought this may be something, because Bob is not easily sold on stuff, and he plays a lawyer on his in his little blog there, and he's actually a pretty good thought mind in the legal sphere, and he thinks it's worthwhile, and so I think that's an interesting take.
The other thing about that is if he prevails, this gets up there with New York Times versus Sullivan as a seminal piece of, you know, New York Times versus Sullivan was the case that established the principle that public officials, you have a higher bar that you have to pass, which was a sensible thing standard in terms of, we want to encourage robust debate. We don't want politicians cowering, afraid to make a charge because of fear of being sued if it's you didn't dot every I or cross every T. I wouldn't be surprised to see something like this come down and say, yes, there are limits when you're in blatant disregard of the truth. Unlimited free speech is not unlimited.
Right, it's fire in the public theater.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
And so I think there is something here. I think there will be if he's successful, it's a magnificently new standard. Because right now, I think we're in this spot, as you just described, that anything goes. You can say whatever you want. It's free speech. I mean, how many times have we all heard that now? Mm-hmm. And that's too much. We know that. The society is living on the edge there. And there has to be some tangible connection to a truth.
And intriguingly, this could be the case that addresses that, you know, New York Times versus Sullivan sort of sets the floor.
Yeah.
And a case like this could set the ceiling.
Right.
To say, yes, free speech, yes, but unlimited free speech.
Right.
You can slander somebody and you know it's false.
Yeah.
And no, there's a point beyond which that does not do any good for anybody.
Right. Gets into the whole narrative that that former President Trump is still selling out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point do you call BS on that and say there's just no truth to it?
And no truth. And there should be a sanction for it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you want to keep something from happening, there has to be some cost.
Yeah.
To doing it.
You have to penalize somebody.
Yeah.
So fascinating place where we find ourselves.
Let's talk about political reforms in the state.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're involved in that a little bit. Our Save Democracy group has done about 2 years of research now on trying to figure out how to fix the problem. So let's define the problem first. The problem first is, as we know, 85% of legislative candidates, both for state legislatures and the Congress, all get elected in the primary. So explain.
There's a place to explain.
So you have safe districts that are uncompetitive because of the way we comply with the Civil Rights Act and we draw them up to communities of interest. They're safe for one party or the other.
Unless, as they used to say, you get caught with a live boy or a dead girl.
Right. Unless there's something really untoward. Jeff Grosskopf back in the day on alt fuels.
Yeah.
So you're guaranteed reelection in 85% if you just adhere to those customers that participate in those primaries.
Which means the majority party, the party that is a substantial majority in your district.
Right. And those primaries constitute maybe 15 to 20% of the electoral turnout.
And
that's who turns out.
Those are the only votes that count.
Right, because that's the only customer that those audiences care about. Mm-hmm. And it's curated because we use taxpayer dollars to fund partisan primaries. Remember, Republican Party, Democratic Party, private organizations, no claim on public taxpayer dollars, but they have owned the election process to determine who gets elected in these districts. It's either going to be a Republican or it's either going to be a Democrat, and they're all going to be chosen in 85% of these districts by that very narrow segment of voters who turn out. So becomes a management problem. If you're elected, then the only constituency you care about is that constituency. To hell with everybody else, because you got to win a primary.
Means that in effect, people elected in those 26 districts out of our 30, the only thing they're worried about is a more extreme candidate from their
beating
own party beating them.
Right. And so, and it goes, the old line is do your job, lose your job. So if you want to compromise, which all political processes require compromise, like on the voucher thing, Ducey wanted 100% vouchers. Maybe you get some vouchers, maybe you do some oversight, maybe you do something like this. You know, there's a gray area. So he jammed through vouchers with 100% of the Republican support without any Democratic support. Now there's hue and cry on the left about, defunding public schools and yada, yada, yada. Well, if any of those Republicans would have undermined Ducey, they lose their primary election. Mm-hmm. So, but most voters want to have a system that works. But or let's take the national deficit we all know it's going to require tax increases and entitlement reform. If Democrats do entitlement reform, they lose their primary election. If Republicans do tax increases, they lose their primary election. So you can't solve the problem. So you just keep kicking the can down the road.
And it's a funny thing. We know exactly how to fix it.
Right.
And it's not going to happen.
Right. Because you're the constituency that those people serve, they are unwilling to compromise. So I mean, this is the old adage. In politics is the only industry where you discourage competition. So what you have to do is reintroduce competition into the cycle. You ought to guarantee that nobody wins in the primary. So nobody is eligible to win a primary outright. So you have to have them face the general election voters with a competitive choice in front of the electorate that makes them compete for that job. So how do you do that? You create an open primary. You simply say, we will no longer spend taxpayer dollars on financing partisan primaries. You're required, all candidates can qualify for the ballot with the same number of signatures. Anybody can sign your petition signature that regardless of party, if you're an eligible voter in that area. And then number three, you have candidates that can play. So you have a wide open ballot that Democrats can vote for Democrats, Republicans can vote for Republicans, but independents can vote for anybody they want outside of
the
primary.
Every candidate has to face every voter.
Everybody's
in every
your constituent.
Election.
Everybody's your constituent, not just your party. Your constituency is defined by who's going to
your
vote.
Your district.
Right. And so you have to market to them. And so you introduce new candidates into the system in that open primary, which requires competition for them to compete for those ideas. And so once you do that, then you create a better outcome. Because competition, as we all know in America, it's helpful.
We do seem to believe in that.
We believe in that.
Actually, it works when you have it.
Right. It works when you have it.
You can't merely pronounce competition. You actually have to have it.
So that's the first part. We open up the entire primary. Let anybody compete. Let anybody vote. Let any candidate qualify who wants to qualify. And then you run the election as if it's a complete open contest. So then the question becomes, how do you run the general election? What do you do? Do you just advance the top two candidates? Mm-hmm. That's what some states do. It's the least bit of reform because in deep, deep blue states or blue states like California, you generally get, you know, a Republican and a Democrat, and the Democrat normally wins the race. Mm-hmm. We're not really that kind of state. We're a deeply purple state where there's wide competition. So top two could be helpful.
But we are deeply purple, but we have there's deeply red and deeply right. blue areas.
So
there just happen to be almost the same number of those.
Right. And so maybe that's a way. I prefer a top five. I prefer an open five. So five people qualify, and then you put those five people, those five top vote getters on the general election ballot. Then what you do is you end up ranking the top five. So the five final finishers are ranked
By the voters.
By the voters. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The fifth place candidate in the general election with the fewest number of votes gets eliminated. If you voted for that person second, your vote gets reallocated. That's very complicated. I can't sell that to Arizona voters.
I mean, it makes eminent sense, but it's difficult to explain.
It's intellectually and competitively the best way to do it. What we're going to say is the legislature will fix this problem with the governor by requiring them to do legislation that they must adopt for the general election. So the legislature will adopt a rule which says no more than five, no less than two. And if you use three or more, ranking has to be required.
Okay.
So nobody can win a ranked choice voting. You can't put four candidates on the ballot and say the top one wins because they only get 20% or 30% of the vote.
So you've established the general principle and the exact number. You've punted that to the legislature.
And the legislature is accountable to the people. Mm-hmm. And they can review and change anything that they want. So let them do it. But let's live with one principle.
But they're left with a choice of two, three, four, or five.
Right. And what we are going to be advocating for is treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. Every voter gets treated the same. Every candidate gets treated the same. If you use taxpayer money to run election and you qualify mm-hmm. for the ballot that way, you have to treat everybody equally. That's a universal supported idea mm-hmm. amongst, you know, all men are created equal, mm-hmm. Equal access to the ballot, treat everybody fairly. There's all kinds of narrative around that, which I believe we win with. Mm-hmm. And so it's a first step in significant election reform, as Terry Goddard did with his dark money stuff. Mm-hmm. We got that finally through. Let's do this as a state. Let's create an open primary. And then let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. Let's see, you know, maybe in 2 years, there's five competitive seats in the legislature this year because Republicans keep shooting themselves in the foot. The Democrats may control one or both chambers next year.
Yeah, some of the close seats may have a Democratic trend. The Republicans sort of got the districts that made sense for them for 2022. But if you look at the changes, they may not sustain.
Right. So we love the idea, and it tests extremely well. The legislature's put on an idea on the ballot that's the exact opposite of this idea. That's a direct primary election. Mm-hmm. You have to run in a Republican or a Democratic primary in order to qualify for the general election. So it's a direct contradiction mm-hmm. of what we're doing. We believe we will win that contest because we will be treating everybody fairly.
So we expect two competing ballots.
There will be two competing ideas. If the legislature doesn't take those off, they leave it on. And we hope to file soon, file petition language soon, and then we will begin collecting signatures sometime, we believe, in latter August or early September.
And it's my understanding that if they both pass, the one with a higher margin
prevails. And I'm pretty sure we're going to get more votes than they will.
If neither passes, we keep the current system.
Keep the current system. That's right.
That's very interesting because I think that what you've done to punt the one part, I think reasonable people could disagree about whether 2, 3, 4, or 5 candidates go to more than five. It's unwieldy. People won't know who's who.
Remember, we're putting this in the Constitution. This is going to go in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So I want to maintain flexibility in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. I want to live on the principle that everybody gets treated equally. And then we can change it. Then the legislature mm-hmm. can change it. We're not dictating one system in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. We're simply saying abide by this set of rules.
And the key element is the one that my big takeaway is everybody votes in every election.
Right. And, everybody can run.
So every candidate has to appeal to every voter, not just partisans.
That's right. That's right.
And, reasonable people could disagree. I don't see the 2, 3, 4, 5. Top of my head, I can't see either party benefiting much from either number.
No, they're going to have to change the way they perform in order to compete in that type of environment.
You're going to have to appeal to
more voters.
To every voter.
Right. You're going to have to have a narrative that appeals to more voters.
Interesting.
Which is what we want. I mean, you want an outcome that produces solutions legislatively that work together. The joke is right now we elect two groups of people who hate each other. Mm-hmm. We put them in
and
the
then
room.
And we ask them to work together.
Right. Put them in the room and say, solve our biggest problems.
You get elected by saying, I'm more anti the other side than anybody else. Then you say, now work together.
And so we get this yo-yo going on you go from the extreme left to the extreme right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't serve America. Well, it doesn't serve our country well. Thankfully, our founders gave each state the right in our Constitution to determine how we elect our representatives. This is a constitutionally based right. We are the state 48, and we are going to own the opportunity to use that ability to fix our problems.
Final word, Chuck Coffin. Interesting. I'm sure we'll talk about this one a lot more.
Yeah, it'll be back
as we get back.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.